This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the potential effects of smoke on Central Coast wine grapes.
It appears to be smoke that's older than 24 hours, actually, within reason, has very limited effect on fruit.
Also, we'll learn about the City of San Luis Obispo's first cannabis store.
People 60 and up are seeking cannabis for relief from arthritis pain, insomnia, stress, or more serious things like cancer.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, September 14th, 2020. I'm Carol Tangeman. Election season is in full swing, and California's ballot is chock full of propositions. One measure would exempt gig companies from a law that makes it harder to classify workers as contractors. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd reports.
Akamine Chiari started driving for Lyft because the flexibility allows him to balance college classes with earning a living.
I was able to prioritize my education, put it first. I could build my work around my schoolwork.
That's why he supports Proposition 22. The measure would allow gig companies to classify their workers as contractors, which would help preserve that flexibility, as opposed to treating them as employees. In exchange, the ballot measure would require gig companies to provide certain benefits to drivers. They would be guaranteed a minimum wage and healthcare subsidies if they clock enough hours on the road. The companies would also cover vehicle insurance and provide safety training. Steve Smith is with the California Labor Federation and the No on Prop 22 campaign. He says the new benefits are not enough and that drivers would still be exploited by the multi-billion dollar companies.
We've got about 800,000 workers in the gig economy that would be affected by Prop 22. They should get workers' comp if they're injured. They should, in fact, get unemployment insurance if they're laid off.
Uber and Lyft have previously threatened to leave California if they are forced to classify their drivers as employees, as required under the law AB 5, which passed last year. So far, a group of the biggest gig companies have spent over $180 million in support of the measure. I'm Scott Rodd.
California voters will decide this fall on a dozen ballot measures, including Proposition 15. And as Cap Radio's Chris Nichols reports, the initiative would raise taxes on big businesses while providing new revenue for schools and local governments.
Prop 15 is expected to raise as much as $12 billion every year for local schools, community colleges, cities, and counties. It would do this by removing a property tax protection for big businesses, one that was granted in the 1970s under Proposition 13. The protection for homeowners would remain. Here's Yes on 15 spokesperson Alex Stack.
We're talking about Hollywood movie studios, companies in Silicon Valley like IBM and Intel, which have been around for decades, haven't changed ownership, are still paying property taxes based on assessments from the 1960s and 70s.
Under Prop 15, these large corporations would have to pay property tax based on current market value. Right now, they pay a much lower rate based on the original purchase price. But Rob Lapsley of the California Business Roundtable says the tax hike would harm not just big companies, but small ones too. Large commercial properties will pass the increase on to smaller tenants, such as restaurants, Lapsley says, in the form of higher rents and fees.
Ultimately, everybody pays this tax. But the most importantly, the small business owner is going to get hit exactly at the wrong time in this economic crisis.
The tax increase would kick in 2022 for some properties, but not until 3 years later for those where half or more of the tenants are small businesses. In Sacramento, I'm Chris Nichols.
A black box theater in Santa Barbara was almost exclusively a rental venue before the pandemic. But since the shutdown, the theater has been pushed into producing its own shows, including a virtual series of story readings from local authors and performers. Sean Flannelly reports for the KCBX News Arts Beat.
When it became clear that audiences wouldn't be coming back for some time, Center Stage Theater's executive director immediately wrote a grant application to the Santa Barbara Foundation for a video production setup, so that once performers could return, they'd have the ability to produce shows.
I think that they are being just wildly brave and innovative. And I think that that's what this moment calls for, is bravery and innovation. And so they are, you know, trying to do different things and also trying to do them really well.
That's Tanya Israel, a professor and author who performed in Center Stage's Personal Stories digital series. Israel says she's admired how Center Stage has been adapting to the new environment so quickly. Personal Stories was one of Center Stage's primary fundraisers before the pandemic, too. But now it's pay-per-view online. The performances are shorter and neater than a monologue, but more structured than freeform stories, like The Moth. Israel's performance started out about her hatred of spoilers, but quickly sagged into a moving tale about her mother's dementia.
One of the last movies we saw together was The Wife. I know this for sure because I can't bear to delete the voicemail where she announced the movie selection, where her voice is clear and upbeat, each word enunciated with precision.
Another Personal Stories performer, Lori Lindop, says stories are critically important right now. We can take lessons from the experiences of others and use them in our own lives.
Maybe if we look to people who have gone through really hard times in the past, it gives us some comfort that you come through on the other side.
Lindop's story strikes a funny but also topical tone. How she hated learning history in school and from her father, until discovering that was only because all she'd ever learned about was the history of white men. Performer Jonathan Young's piece chronicles attending his high school reunion and all the personal realizations that came along with it. Young says one of the challenges of replicating the Personal Stories performances virtually is recreating the same black box theater experience.
Part of the beauty of the Personal Stories series is how intimate the setting is and how personal the stories are.
Still, Young says the theater's production and direction created an intimacy that comes through a screen. At this point, Personal Stories is Center Stage's primary mode of income, along with donations. They've sold over 300 tickets to the videos and raised over $7,000 in donations. The theater has had to drastically cut hours for one position and lay off its part-time box office and house managers. Executive Director Terry Ball says the Paycheck Protection Program loans were critical to the company's survival early on, but now their productions are all essentially fundraisers for the theater. At the moment, the company is working on a few plays for socially distanced production and planning for three separate dance productions performed without an audience. It's also looking at scripts for productions staged entirely over Zoom. Reporting for the KCBX News Arts Beat, I'm Sean Flannelly.
Air quality on the Central Coast has suffered due to the wildfires across California. Correspondent Tom Wilmer visits with a Central Coast grape grower who talks about the possible effects of smoke particles on wine grapes.
Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery. Hi, Vic.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming out.
Interesting days compounded by the recent fires up in Northern California, Santa Clara and San Mateo County, with the smoke wafting down here all the way to the Central Coast, has horrifically affected you guys in ways you don't even quite know the depth of yet.
Well, unfortunately, that's absolutely correct. We won't really know the extent of any smoke taint for months, for sure. And even trying to evaluate fruits for potential smoke taint is more complicated than it seems. It's actually almost impossible to do in advance.
You have your fires, let's say, at their full throttle, and the smoke wafts down here to the Central Coast and then filters down onto your grapes. Why could you not wash the smoke off?
They've actually done experimentation with exactly that. I actually sat in on a Zoom session with COG, California Association of Wine Grape Growers, recently. Dr. Anita Oberholster from UC Davis was one of the hosts of the panel, and she's done a lot of research on smoke taint and how it affects grapes, mediation methods, which they're still working on, unfortunately. So they have done exactly that. People have attempted to come through and wash the fruit. People have come through and attempted to bathe the fruit in organic stylet oils, both pre or post smoke event. If they knew it was coming, like you're watching the news and you see the smoke direction, even though you may not have fires, it's going to come your way in 2 or 3 days. People have tried remediation methods in the vineyard in advance of smoke arriving.
And what would they do?
Well, basically, they were trying a number of different oils, stylet and otherwise, to actually try to pre-coat the grapes, to hopefully to trap capture some of the smoke, so then they could be subsequently washed or rinsed in some manner, rinsing immediately after the smoke event. None of these methods seem to show any difference between the control and the treated fruit.
Wow. So bottom line, you're stuck with smoke.
Right. So, you know, they've done a lot of research both at Davis, and they've done a fair amount of research in Australia because they've been plagued by the same thing with wildfires. And what they have found so far, they haven't found a remediation method. They haven't found a remediation method for the wines that appears to be effective all the time. What they have found is it appears that the age of the smoke has a huge impact. And it appears to be smoke that's older than 24 hours actually, within reason, has very limited effect on fruit.
So this is airborne, floating, smoke, wafting down the coast.
Yes. So in this instance, I'm not entirely sure how long it was between, and the smoke we saw, I'm sure, was primarily from the fires in Monterey County, the River Fire near Salinas, the Dolan Fire near Big Sur. But, you know, realistically, in the big picture, the growers here, I don't think have a ton of things to worry about in that. I mean, of course, I'm judging it by what we saw here in Templeton, and, you know, further north, San Miguel might have seen a little more smoke, but we had 2 bad days and 1 horrendous day, and that was really it. You know, to follow up on the smoke taint issue, you don't really know, because at this present moment, there's not a way to taste the fruit and say, oh yeah, that's got smoke taint, or to actually have the fruit analyzed, because smoke's components are a class of compounds called volatile phenols. And they actually, when they settle on the fruit, they bind with both the skins, the color, and tannins in the skins, and the sugar. So they aren't released until fermentation. In other words, until fermentation actually happens and the sugar is converted to alcohol, these smoke compounds, or a whole group of compounds called volatile phenols, they aren't actually released from the reaction that they've formed with the grape skins and the grape sugars until fermentation.
So they're little time bombs, and you don't know how they're going to go off until you've processed and done fermentation, correct?
To a large degree, that's true. What they have done and have had some success in correlating what might happen in the large-scale fermentation is they've suggested growers pick fruit at, you know, a minimum of about 22% sugar, 22 Brix, which, you know, normal red wine fermentation would be, you know, 24 to 26 sugar at harvest. So they're saying pick it early, like 7 to 10 days early, do a little micro-fermentation, and then you can take that wine from that micro-fermentation 7-10 days later, before you're still harvesting your large lot out of the vineyard, and you can then take it to the lab, because if those compounds are in your micro-fermentation wine, they are highly likely to be in the wine made from the larger batch.
In a worst-case scenario, the other day you were saying you could wind up with a product in the end that tastes like an ashtray.
That's pretty accurate. Yeah, unsaleable. And they've tried remediation efforts in the winery once smoke starts to show up. And it's not immediate. It may take months to show up in the wine after fermentation, or even longer. They've tried flash pasteurization, reverse osmosis, spinning cone centrifuge. None of these methods seem to affect the level in the wine. The only thing that they have been able to remove it with is activated carbon, which of course is a legal additive to wine for fining. But unfortunately, activated carbon is relatively harsh and removes a lot of your beneficial aromatics as well. So you will turn up with a wine that doesn't have the ashtray campfire aromatic and flavor, but it doesn't have what it had or should have had.
Pretty boring. Okay, so here you are a grower. You have approximately 80 acres of grapes that you tend and manage and harvest. And right now you're in the early days of harvesting. The only way you can proceed is based on your little test batches?
That's the only thing that's going to give you any indication.
So if you take that 21 bricks little micro harvest and you ferment and you lab test and it comes back negative, does that mean that acre of 2 tons or 3 tons of grapes you let rot on the vine?
If it comes back with a high level, so it's not a 0 or 100, it's a scale. And at lower levels, even in your test fermentation, you're probably going to have very low levels in your tank fermentation, large batch fermentation, and it's not going to be an issue. It's in other words, it's below threshold. So this is all, until they get to a certain level, you're not going to pick it up in the wine. So, and it's not quite as dire as it's not a 0 or 100. You know, if you have a small amount, that doesn't mean the whole batch is ruined. A small amount is never going to, that you can pick it up in the lab, but if you can't pick it up from a sensory evaluation, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, the lab number doesn't really matter. It's sensory evaluation is what.
Yeah, same thing with harvest, right? It's really biting the seed and tasting the grape as much as it is your numbers and analytics.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, are the vines in good shape? You know, are they going to handle the fruit being on for another 5 to 7 days? Does the fruit taste the way you want it to now? You know, the absolute numbers are a guideline, but, you know, they're not the only thing you use when you pick.
So they're always throwing some wrench at you, aren't they?
It's not boring. So, in winemaking, wine grape growing, a lot of people forget, but it's really very specialized farming. And farmers are kind of used to these things happening. You can have completely unpredicted events. I mean, you can have insect pests. You would never think grasshoppers. Well, you can have grasshoppers come in such numbers, they'll actually strip the vines of leaves. Thank goodness we haven't had one of these events in this county in probably 30 years, but there were some times that it did happen. So, early rain, early freeze.
And the birds are your buddies.
Birds are always a problem. So, here we net the entire vineyard over the course of a few weeks to, it's a 99% effective method to keep the birds off of your fruit. It's also neighbor friendly. You know, some of your other efforts to keep birds off include, some type of noisemakers, shotguns, scare balloons, Mylar tape. They're all effective, but we found netting to be the most effective of all of them, also the quietest for the neighbors.
All said and done, back to smoke and harvest. Does that imply that you have to do these little micro fermented batches as you go through your vines, or could you do a block and your comes in good, so you're good to go for that whole area?
Well, again, during the meeting that we all attended via Zoom, is they did say, unfortunately, I guess if you had a perfectly tabletop flat vineyard with no differences in, wind or elevation or lack of wind, you could probably do one sample for the entire vineyard. But, with topography we have in most of the vineyards in Paso Robles, you have, even within a relatively small vineyard, you'll have markedly different topography.
So hilltops might take the brunt.
It could, absolutely. So in other words, the only true way to do it is to be 100% confident. The only way is to do small batch fermentations for each harvest block that you intend to do, or at least every other harvest block. If you have two side-by-side that are the same topography, you can probably get away with one. But now, one thing they did find is if you wash any ash off the fruit, that does make a difference. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily save it, but it definitely minimizes the amount of smoke taint you're going to pick up from the fruit.
Vic Roberts, thanks for sharing.
My pleasure, Tom. Good seeing you again.
We've been speaking with Vic Roberts, the owner of Victor Hugo Winery in Templeton, California. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
What does it take to keep a downtown vibrant during good times as well as challenging times? Bettina Swigger from Downtown Slow and Robin Elander from Downtown Santa Barbara talk about how each city is responding to COVID-19 and imagining new ways for downtowns to operate as spaces for people to live, work, and play.
For Issues and Ideas, this is Bettina Swigger for our feature called Around Downtown. In addition to my duties as a KCBX radio host, I also serve as the CEO of Downtown Slow, the business association serving downtown San Luis Obispo. For today's segment, we're going to be speaking with Robin Elander, who is the interim executive director of Downtown Santa Barbara. Welcome to Issues and Ideas, Robin.
Thanks so much for having me.
So excited to have a little chat with you. I'm sure that we have a lot in common, but there are also a lot of differences as well. So wanted to start off just by getting a little bit of a background from you. How did you get into this work of downtown management?
I've actually only been involved in this particular position since May 11th. So just at a major turning point for our downtown, because we turned our downtown into a temporary promenade only several weeks later for Memorial Day weekend. But prior to this role, I've been serving as the executive director for another nonprofit organization that puts on events and festivals in our area called the Summer Solstice Celebration and Parade. So I've been doing that for the last 5 years, and then prior to that, doing quite a number of community initiatives, events in our downtown community. So that's kind of my precursor work to this role, as well as in Ventura. I worked for the City of Ventura Cultural Affairs Division for 7 years and did a lot of work on the revitalization and cultural programming for downtown Ventura.
Gosh, it's so interesting the parallel paths our career take. I also have a background in festival production. I used to manage a festival Mosaic. And I also worked in cultural affairs in Colorado.
Oh. How about that? So interesting.
So I think that leads really nicely into my next question, which is, how are downtowns the cultural center of our communities?
It is really often the space that brings people together. There's always interesting things happening. Our downtown has quite a lot of cultural institutions. We have the Granada Theater, the Arlington Theater, the Libero Theater, Victoria Theater, many different organizations and performing arts groups that not only utilize those spaces, but have quite a number of programs within the downtown core.
We have fewer historic theaters. We do have the Fremont Theater, which opened in the 1930s, and I believe that Laurel and Hardy performed at the opening performance of the Fremont. And it's interesting because that actually sat kind of vacant for a couple of years and more recently has gone through a real revitalization to become a concert venue. But it was a movie theater for a long time. They also have some worship services there. So that's our main theater. We don't have quite as many as Santa Barbara does, but we also have other cultural institutions. So the San Luis Obispo Repertory Theater is a wonderful, growing repertory theater company with about 100 seats. And then also the Slow Museum of Art. We also have public art throughout the downtown. And I know that's a big part of what makes places so inviting and inspires that culture to happen. In San Luis Obispo, for example, we have painted electrical boxes. So instead of just seeing boring gray utility boxes, you see vivid, bright reimaginings from local artists about what makes our community special. Do you have anything like that in Santa Barbara?
Super cool. We have some temporary art installations and a number of mural projects and mosaics in our area. We don't have those electrical boxes. I know Ventura did, but sometimes we have intriguing like bookcases that are part of it. We have Pianos on State, which is a temporary project that usually happens in October where local artisans paint different pianos and they're out on State Street and people can play them at like 10 different locations. This year, we're trying to figure out, you know, how to do that project in homage to the regular thing because, you know, with COVID, touching pianos and all of that stuff is another situation, but that is, you know, something we regularly do.
It's a little awkward for us, right? Because we're accustomed to using music and inviting artists to come enliven spaces so that commercial activity can happen. And in the county guidelines, at least in San Luis Obispo County, live music is prohibited, even if it's one person. So
right, same here.
That's a hard moment, and I hope maybe we can get to a different threshold for both of our communities. It's so meaningful to walk through a public space and hear live music.
So true. I actually met with about 15 of our cultural institutions and performing arts organizations yesterday, and we're really trying to come together to figure out how we can reopen that part of our community safely and figure out a way that we can have a individual musician where they're just performing acoustically or, you know, with a guitar. Maybe they have a mask on, or maybe there's some kind of a screen in front of them so that, you know, it is safer, and they have something like a 6-foot, like cordoned off area in front of them, and some signage so that they could perform. So it's something that we're trying to figure out, but you're right. Currently the regulations do not allow that, but they are musicians, performing groups, artisans. They're a huge part of our local business economy. And so they need to be really considered in this entire process, because so far it's been a focus on restaurants, retail, and these types of organizations. And they're just as much of a part of our community as those.
We have a lot of artists and artisans who work in the service industry, so they may not have a primary job. They might have two or three different jobs because the cost of living where we are, where our downtowns are located, is very high. Mm-hmm. And people pay that premium because there's a lot of quality of life. But if you take away the quality of life of the art experience being there, then how do you serve the service class is another topic, which we probably won't be able to solve in our downtown business organizations.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. Downtown SLO's Bettina Swigger is talking to Robin Elander from downtown Santa Barbara.
I know that you've been working really closely with the city of Santa Barbara on this promenade project on State Street. How did that come about, and what role did your organization play?
So it came about as a way to support our business community, because it became very apparent that the only way that our businesses, particularly restaurants, were going to be able to stay operating at all was to have additional space outside of their business to be able to have patrons sit outside. Initially, everything was takeout for the first several months of the stay-at-home order. But it became clear that once it was going to be able to reopen, that we established with in conjunction with the business community and our organization an emergency ordinance that allowed for 10 blocks of State Street to be closed and set up as a promenade so that businesses were able to use the sidewalk and the street in front of their businesses to allow for outdoor dining and commercial use. So retail is also able to use it. And so now it's really created a new vibrant energy for our downtown. Certainly there's a long way to go because some of our businesses are still not able to be open, but it's really helped quite a bit. And so that emergency ordinance was for 3 months initially, and it was recently extended another 3 months. So it's set to end December 8th right now, with a possibility to extend another 3 months depending on what the conditions are like. What is happening in SLO in regards to that?
It's a little different, but definitely parallel. Again, we have a program called Open SLO, which was adopted by the City Council in May, and that was a year-long pilot program to allow for expanded use of the right-of-way and create more space, as you described, for retail and other commercial activities to take place. It started in sort of different iterations. I think we actually saw what was happening in Santa Barbara, saw the success that you were having, and tried to duplicate that on our Higuera Street, but it wasn't quite as successful. In part, I think because there are different swaths of the geography where there weren't businesses that were capable of participating. So the the program has shifted considerably, and now it's really focusing on the parklet aspect. And there's been a new bike lane installed on Higuera Street, so narrowing the vehicle traffic from 3 lanes to 2 lanes, allowing more bicycles to come through, and also just slowing down the traffic patterns a little bit.
Right.
So it's been interesting to see. The ordinance is a pilot program for up to a year, which means that a lot of the parklets now are going from just sort of temporary plastic barriers and cement barriers that were dragged in from construction sites into really beautiful spaces with planters and fairy lights. And they're taking on the character of the individual restaurants that were inside. They're now decorating the outside. So we're looking ahead to how we can invigorate that process and also use those lighting projects as part of our holiday celebrations. Mm-hmm. We're now looking ahead to the holiday seasons, which are going to look different for all of us,
right?
But especially in downtowns, that's where you come to do your shopping and see the pretty lights and interact with the windows, and it'll be an interesting time.
We usually have a pretty major holiday parade at that time.
We do too.
More than 100,000 people, and so obviously we cannot do that. So we're transitioning to a holiday market concept instead. In regard to the parklets, we have a program here in a similar fashion. So there's some parklets on State Street, and then there's also parklets on the side streets that are each of the intersections between each block is not close to traffic. So one section of street, 10 blocks, is close to traffic, but the side streets remain open so you can pass through.
Got it. So you're probably becoming a transportation expert in your new role.
Of sorts. And we are trying to figure out how to handle the biking aspect, because it is open right now to biking, pedestrians, skateboards, as well as those outdoor dining uses. But we have had challenges with speeds of biking, and also there's a kind of a new trend across the nation for young people to be practicing wheelies. And we have kind of a significant group of people who've been, you know, doing wheelie stunts in the middle of the street that are creating some unsafe conditions. So we're trying to, through education, work on that, but it has become an issue.
Just wild to think about.
I know.
Well, and that's why downtowns are so cool, right? It's the intersection of all of these different ways that human beings come together, whether it's to share a meal, to try out a new outfit, to walk around and look at architecture, to visit a cultural institution, or apparently to do wheelies.
Right. It's really kind of wild, like each day to try to reconfigure every event that's ever gone on in downtown, whether it's a parade to a festival to a simple this or that. It has to be completely different this year. So every day is really a unique troubleshooting mission right now.
Absolutely. It's the daily problem solving academy is what it feels like. But it's also been a really interesting sort of quasi PhD program in urban planning, because I also didn't expect that I would be telling retailers what kind of processes and procedures they would need to use to run transactions on their cash register. And we found ourselves in a position where we were distributing materials, personal protective equipment, to our businesses when we were going through the reopening process. And so there's just elements of the work that continues to be dynamic, surprising, and we're trying to make it joyful as much as we can. Yeah, so let's take just a quick moment to talk about the larger economic issues at hand. We're hearing about the exodus of office culture from downtowns as more and more people are working remotely. We're seeing that a little bit. The foot traffic in our downtown has decreased somewhat, but we don't have the towering skyscrapers in either of our downtowns that some of the other more urban areas may have. Are you at all thinking, you know, 2-3 years in advance about what the changing foot traffic day to day will look like in downtown Santa Barbara?
You know, a little bit. I think that is a really good question mark. You know, there are quite a number of technology companies that have major office spaces, including Amazon Alexa has an office downtown here. We have
Yeah, we have an Amazon outlet too.
Yeah, okay. So we also have some major other tech spaces like Logic Monitor, Invoca, and even Zoom has their space here. So Zoom is obviously rocking it, but they're probably still, we're on Zoom at the moment, but most people are still operating from their homes. And so we have seen some people coming back, but over time, I do think people will come back to their offices. I think there will be more of a opportunity for people to do both. I don't envision that office space will fully go away, because I don't think people are, in most cases, are finding it extremely productive to be working from their home in all cases. A lot of people have kids, or it's just not as an inspiring space, but others are finding it very productive and more useful. And so I think a combination of both is actually very valuable, and it reduces, you know, carbon footprint as well.
I actually think it's a good opportunity for people to rediscover their downtowns. We're not traveling as much. Free parking, at least for the limited time. So that's always a topic that gets discussed when we bring up downtowns. Well, there's lots more to discuss, and hopefully we can have another conversation.
Absolutely. It's so wonderful to connect with you and find out what's happening in SLO and just collaborate on these things, because we can support each other. And, you know, it's interesting to find out what's happening right next door.
Thanks so much for the conversation, Robin. Really appreciate
it.
And this has been Around Downtown for KCVX Issues and Ideas. I'm Bettina Swigger.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCVX. I'm Carol Tangeman. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Issues and Ideas on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Working Lunch is a Facebook Live conversation between the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce and someone in the community doing interesting or innovative work. Today, we'll learn about the city of San Luis Obispo's first cannabis store.
Welcome to Working Lunch, the Slow Chamber's weekly series where we get to sit down with our community leaders and bring back some of that connection we've been missing during these challenging COVID times. I'm Jim D'Antona, President and CEO of the Slow Chamber, and today you'll get a peek into the part of my conversation with co-founder and CEO of Slow's first cannabis retailer, Megan Souza. She has co-founded four businesses in the hemp and cannabis space: Megan's CBD Market Hemp Retail Store, Megan's Organic Market, a Prop 215 cannabis retail delivery service, the Red Truck Cannabis Company, one of only six licensed cannabis cultivation operations in Slo County, and most recently, Megan's Organic Market, Prop 64 storefront dispensary, the first dispensary in Slo. Thank you so much for being here, Megan.
I'm so glad to be here.
You just opened the first legal cannabis retail store in Slo. How did you get into the cannabis business, and when did you know this was what you wanted to do?
So I got into the cannabis business starting with cultivation. My partner, Eric, and I started with farming, and it was just a side business at first. We were cultivating in Cayucas at our little farm and retailing wholesale to other dispensaries, mostly in Southern California. It was when I was wanting to drop out of a master's program at Cal Poly that I started the retail component of our business. The time that I knew that it was what I wanted to pursue in a serious lifelong career way is when it transitioned from being about retailing cannabis to being about influencing regulations and participating in local government in a more serious and direct way.
You've always had such a distinct brand. What inspired your vision for Megan's Organic Market?
What inspired it was a desire to just come out of the shadows, both personally as a cannabis user and cannabis business operator, and also I just wanted to normalize cannabis use as much as possible and make it more approachable to people who really needed it as medicine, I would say, is what birthed our unique branding. And that branding is defined, I think, by wholesomeness and approachability. It started with our Proposition 215 retail delivery service. And that retail model is really different because, you know, we go into people's homes and it's a very intimate kind of experience. People, you know, we get to know people's pets and families and everything about their health conditions. And now we are a storefront dispensary in downtown Slo and people come to us. In both situations, we do a lot of introducing people to cannabis for the very first time. So a lot of education and a lot of addressing incorrect assumptions about what cannabis is and what's available and how it should be used and can be used. And yeah, so we have a lot of first-time cannabis users and new cannabis users, which is not at all what we expected when we started the business.
You've now been open at the intersection of High and South Higueras. What's it been like to actually finally be in that space? Because it's been a long time coming, right?
Yeah, it's been such a long time coming, and it's been awesome to be in that space. We turned a pretty rough-looking old building into something really beautiful, in my opinion. Some of the most interesting developments, I guess, since we've been a storefront is getting to see new products that have recently become available to the retail market, including cannabinoids that weren't previously available, like CBN and CBG and THCV and THCA and all of these interesting non-psychoactive and less psychoactive cannabinoids that people are seeking nowadays. And then another interesting thing is just the trends. It's surprising to learn that there are people lined up before we open at 9 a.m. I never would have thought that people would be wanting to buy cannabis at 9 a.m., but they do. So definitely our busiest times are right when we open and right before we close.
There is the stereotype of the cannabis user who might not get up before noon. Who are your customers? How is that different from what you expected?
When we first started our delivery service way back in 2013, we thought that our clientele would be Cal Poly students, would be, you know, young people who were seeking cannabis for recreational purposes mostly. That was not at all the case. It was mostly seniors, mostly people 60 and up who were seeking cannabis for relief from arthritis pain, insomnia, stress, or more serious things like cancer and serious pain relief. And then when we started our storefront, because we're the first storefront in SLO, we have the entire gamut of cannabis users, young people, older people, sick people, people using it recreationally. But we definitely still see more people seeking low dose, non-psychoactive cannabis products for pain relief or sleep. So definitely more medical users, definitely more seniors, and definitely more women than most storefront retailers get as clientele, I think.
Is the customer getting really educated now on what's out there and some of this, you know, specialties?
Yeah. So that is something that was not the case before. There just was not a lot of research on cannabis, unfortunately, because it wasn't legal in the United States, at least, to do research for so long. In my previous experience with our Prop 215 delivery service, so much of the time we were people's very first introduction to the word cannabis, to the concept of cannabinoids, to the fact of an endocannabinoid system. But now with our storefront and the availability of information and the amount of new research that's available, we have people who walk in to say, I'm looking for a low dose CBG product to help regulate my glucose level. Or I'm looking for a THCV product that is minimally psychoactive and helps me focus at work. I'm shocked at how knowledgeable people are nowadays.
This area is obviously very familiar with its wine industry. Tourists are coming specifically for types of products. Do you see this as a part of the cannabis industry long-term, as a kind of that cannabis tourism?
Yeah, absolutely. Cannabis tourism, I believe, is the future of SLO for sure, or a cannabis and wine tourism together cooperatively, hopefully. Big piece of that puzzle, though, is the cultivation component. We only have had one local brand of locally cultivated cannabis flower on our shelves so far. We bought everything that was available, and it sold out in less than a week. We need more of that. People want locally produced cannabis products. Right now, our regulations aren't extremely conducive to that. But starting in January, the state will be creating an Appellations of Origin program for the cannabis industry, which will be modeled after the AVAs for wine. Hopefully that will go a long way to promoting and supporting local cannabis cultivation in SLO County.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You're listening to a conversation between the SLO Chamber of Commerce's Jim D'Antona and Megan Souza of Megan's Organic Market.
You know, what does your typical day look like? Is it closer to that of, any other retail store, or what, you know, or more like what people might see in a movie?
Definitely nothing like what people would see in a movie. I have a lot of people asking, how did you get into this industry? It's so cool. Oh my God, I want to do what you do. It's just like any other business. It's just, you know, paperwork and navigating regulations, and it's not very sexy at all. Being in the storefront dispensary is a really special kind of energy, and that's really fun. But the actual like running of the business, the back of the house stuff, is just, I just spend my entire life writing emails, basically.
I'm familiar with that. Steph, what's your favorite part of running your business?
So I've been working as the purchasing manager so far for the dispensary. Doing the buying is really, really fun. Seeing what's out there, having the vendors come and do educational demos and presentations. But yeah, just seeing what's out there and also identifying gaps in the market and what products are available has been a nice little side benefit. We're working on starting some in-house brands. But yeah, being able to be the first one to see the upcoming stuff is definitely sort of fun and exciting.
What kind of innovation is happening in the industry? Is it mostly on the plant side? Is it how the products are being done? Or are there any products on the cusp here of being super popular that you would think is the next big thing?
Yes. So many innovations, so many next big things coming to the cannabis industry. Every day I'm blown away to discover like a new type of product that's available, a whole new product category. Right now we're finding beverages, infused beverages are really popular. People are really liking them as an alternative to alcohol. And it definitely helps folks reduce their alcohol consumption. It's been really popular with the day wine drinking crowd, like my mom and her friends come and get the sparkling. There's a company called Canned, and they make sparkling beverages that are just 2 milligrams of THC and 4 milligrams of CBD. Those are one of our most popular products. And then some other really innovative and interesting things coming down the line are the new cannabinoid products. A lot of customers are asking about CBG who have diabetes, gut problems. THCV products are another exciting new line of things coming out. And then also fancy culinary products, like things to cook with. We have infused sriracha and infused olive oil and some fun cooking ingredients.
It must be interesting being on the front line there and getting to see these things come to fruition. You know, the grow in Slo County has been limited, and it sometimes people don't see it as a traditional agriculture. People, as I might compare it to wine, do you find that to be a helpful metaphor, or are there some ways it might be kind of misleading?
Comparing cannabis to wine is, I suppose, it's helpful. I think that the wine industry had a similar battle to become accepted, particularly here in Slo County. So in a similar way, we face opposition. And in a similar way, cultivating wine, at least when it was first taking its foothold here in Slo County, was more profitable than some other row crops. So I think some of those traditional row crop farmers felt some animosity probably toward the incoming wine grape growers. And similarly with cannabis, cannabis is one of the very few things that you can grow 3 acres of on a small family farm and be profitable. So I think that some people are afraid of cannabis pushing out traditional ag. One other main conflict with traditional ag is overspraying. Cannabis is subjected to a lot of testing, so we can't use any inorganic pesticides. And if neighboring farmers overspray their pesticides onto cannabis, they could be liable for crop loss that cannabis doesn't pass testing. And so that is definitely a concern that some avocado farmers have who consistently overspray. And it's a tricky situation because, you know, we want avocados to be affordable and available, but we also want cannabis to be safe and grown organically and also available. So we have to find ways to work together cooperatively and harmoniously. And I definitely believe that we can do that.
You know, some folks will say, well, can't you just grow indoors? And do you have a thought about growing it indoors?
I do. It's definitely not environmentally friendly. It takes a lot of energy inputs to grow under lights, whereas, you know, sunshine is free. Our commitment is to growing in the native soil, in the ground, under full sun. And doing so, we get the influence of the terroir, of the native climate, the native soil. That's the direction that cannabis is going, in my opinion, is more toward wine. People care about how it's grown, where it's grown, and the influences of that unique climate to how the final product comes out. When you grow indoors, you don't get any of that. Imported soil, controlled climate, it's just a different kind of a thing.
So I know that you also, you know, besides your, you know, grow and the cultivation you're doing and the storefront here in Slo, you also have a CBD store in Morro Bay. What's the major difference between cannabis and hemp or CBD?
So the difference is a legal difference. In California, hemp is cannabis, or in the United States, actually. Hemp is cannabis with 0.3% THC or less. The main difference is that hemp is not heavily regulated or heavily taxed, whereas cannabis is tracked from seed all the way to sale, and it is taxed at multiple points along that process. It's really expensive and time-consuming to acquire a permit to cultivate or manufacture or distribute or process or retail cannabis. Doing so for hemp, not as expensive or challenging.
Can you produce CBD from the hemp?
Both hemp and cannabis produce CBD. In our dispensary, we sell THC-free only CBD products, but they're produced from cannabis. We sell the same THC-free CBD only products in our CBD store in Morro Bay, but not taxed, not tracked and traced in the same ways. So you don't have to pay the excise tax if you purchase your CBD products from Megan's CBD Market.
Can you share a little of your perspective experience being the kind of local pioneer into this space and what went well or didn't?
Yeah, as far as being the first storefront in SLO, definitely first to market is always an advantage. As the only store, they come to us. Once they come to us, we like to think they will always keep coming back because we offer a pretty unique experience. Being the first means that we get to set the scene, set the tone of what cannabis retail in SLO could and should and will be like. And that's a privilege and a responsibility. I think we're doing it pretty well.
What does the future have in store for Megan's Organic Market? And what do you hope to be doing in like a year or two from now?
A year or two from now, I hope to be opening up a dispensary in Paso Robles and Morro Bay and some cities outside of the county, hopefully Santa Barbara County and Fresno. So pursuing more dispensary permits is definitely on the immediate agenda. It's the part that really excites me. Going to these different cities and counties, getting to know their processes and their decision makers and seeing how we can make ourselves fit in with these different communities and write community benefit plans for these different areas.
Yeah, and hopefully that will tear down the wall of how scary it is, right?
Yes, absolutely. We are doing our best to normalize the cannabis retail experience by making it just like a regular store. So it doesn't look like a dispensary or feel like a dispensary. There is a security guard out front only because that state law requires that there be one. But beyond that, you walk in, you pick up a shopping basket and just walk around and put stuff in your shopping cart and walk up to the counter and check out. It's just like a regular experience. Normalization of cannabis use and cannabis retail and cannabis business is definitely our goal.
That was Megan Souza of Megan's Organic Market speaking with Jim D'Antona of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.